All right. It is good to see you all here today. And my name is Timothy Jones, and I am professor of leadership and church ministry here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I did my doctorate here and have written several different books and things like that. But if you want to look those up, you can go to the bookstore and look at those there. I don't want to bore you with the details of that at this time. So what I want us to talk about today is looking at different controversies about who Jesus was and what Jesus said and what Jesus did, specifically controversies about the Gospels. Look at different controversies about the Gospels. Now, I'm going to choose the individual that I consider to be the best example out there, because if we can go and we can look at Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, and we can look at all sorts of people like that and find that and just criticize what they have to say, and that's easy. Those are easy targets. But how many of you have heard of Bart Ehrman? Has anybody heard of Bart Ehrman? So a few of you have. I want to introduce you to who he is, and I want to show a brief video clip to introduce you to who he is, and there's maybe some things that are slightly offensive in it. Hopefully you're not easily offended by it, because it's the best way I know to get the fact that he is able to get stuff out to lay people, to ordinary people, buy into what he has to say, and yet at the same time, he's able to make some claims about the Gospels that obviously as we as believers in Jesus Christ just cannot go with what he has to say. Very popular in many circles, and so let's actually just take a look at him. Now, I want you to, in seeing all of that and seeing what he has to say right there, this is somebody who used to be or used to claim to be an evangelical believer in Jesus Christ. That's what Bart Ehrman says, that he used to be an evangelical believer in Jesus Christ. And in the midst of this, he finally concluded that he didn't. Now, here's the difficulty right here. Now, what if you are just a seeker after truth and you see that on TV, and he's been on Jon Stewart's show, he's been on Colbert, he's on all these different ones. If you see that, what is going to threaten your faith if you're a seeker who is not informed in terms of contemporary controversies about Jesus? What's you're going to find out? Tell me the people in your life, what are they going to be challenged by in this? I mean, this guy's really smart, and he turned from the faith in Jesus Christ, then who am I to believe in this? And right, but he's getting the word out. You're right. He's getting the word out, though, to the people in the pew, so to speak. He's getting the word out to them, not just to scholars, but you're right. And so he's able on those to spout what he has to say without anybody really in challenging him, at least challenging him in a reasonable, rational way. I mean, Colbert's challenging him, but in a rational way. They will question the sufficiency of Scripture just because of the way it's presented in something like that. And I want to wrestle with some of these things. Now, I want to tell you one thing. If you want to deal with just the aspect of it, just the one aspect of it to do with the text, the credibility of the text being copied, my book, Misquoting Truth, actually is a rejoinder to that. So, and so not just to promote my own book, but it is the rejoinder to what he has to say in his book, Misquoting Jesus, my book, Misquoting Truth, from InterVarsity Press. And it deals with that. In this, we don't have the time in this lecture to be able to deal with the textual issues. We don't really have the time to deal with that. But I want to deal with some historical issues in this. And I call it learning to boil your own egg. Let me tell you what I meant by that. When I was raised in a church in which there were really three primary enemies that we were presented with in this church, and they were Russians, rock music, and the Revised Standard Version, okay? Let's just kind of, those were the three major enemies that we had, were Russians, rock music, and this is the late 70s, and those three were pretty things that were going to destroy the faith. And in the Revised Standard Version perhaps could attest in some aspects, but the other two, I don't know that they were going to really destroy the faith in quite the way that they were expected to. Well, there came a time in my life when I really started to question a lot of things I'd been told, and in the midst of questioning a lot of the things I'd been told, I didn't have a Revised Standard Version of the Bible, and I didn't know any Russians, so I tried the rock music one. And so what I ended up doing in the midst of that is I had been told by one of these pastors that rock music is so harmful that if you take an egg and put it in front of rock music for long enough, it will hard boil that egg. I mean, I was literally was told this, and it was in a revival that this guy claimed this. And so if you put that in there, and he says it'll do the same thing basically to your brain. And so this, and so I thought, okay, let's try it. Let's just try this right here. So I took an egg and put it in front of the speaker, and I rolled up the speaker to vast all the stations till I got a rock music station, and I left it there. And I left it there for 2 weeks. And by the end of the 2 weeks, when I cracked it open, it did not smell pleasant at that point right there, as it sitting as it was in front of there by my window, in that right there. But it never hard-boiled, okay? It never hard-boiled during that. And what I did in that is I did for the first time something that I wish I'd been trained to do before, which was to take what I had been told and to test it. To take what I'd been told and test it. Not to become a skeptic or anything like that, but to take what I had been told and to test it. I want you to take what you believe about the Gospels and test it. That's what I really want you to do, is to learn to boil your own egg, to be able to take what you've been told about the Gospels and test it, so that when others come to you with challenges about your faith, you are able to respond in ways that are reasonable and winsome and yet very well reasoned in terms of understanding who Jesus was and what he had to say. I want to look first at what can we really know about Jesus. Here's the claims I want to make. First off, the testimony about Jesus was copied accurately. That one right there, we don't have time to get into, but as I said, you can look at my book, Misquoting Truth, and it has a significant section about this. Was formulated soon after his death and circulated reliably, was connected to eyewitnesses, and was substantiated by independent accounts that agree in crucial details. And we'll look at each of those and unpack those as we go. First off, just to give you an idea, kind of the time that we're looking at right here. In terms of the time we're looking at, if we go back to AD 30, that's when Jesus was crucified. And if we go to 33 is around that time, the conversion of Paul. And we start looking and we start getting letters and words about Jesus in 49, letter to the Galatians, first letter to the Corinthians around 55, the year 64, the fire in Rome, which Nero was emperor at that time. Mark's gospel written in the mid 70s, between 70 and 90, Luke's and Matthew's gospels, 70 to 100 in that range, John's gospel, the gospels of Thomas, Peter, and all these others come from about 110 to 170. So that gives you an idea. When I start tossing out dates, I want to give you a broad picture of the different dates that we're talking about for all the different documents that we're looking at. Now I want to start looking at some skeptics' claims about the gospels, about what we can know, the skeptics' claims. Here's, for example, something from Bart Ehrman. Here's what he has to say in one of his books. Stories based on eyewitness accounts are not necessarily reliable. And the same is true a hundredfold for accounts that, even if stemming from reports of eyewitnesses, have been in oral circulation long after the fact. Imagine playing telephone over the expanse of the Roman Empire, some 2,500 miles across, with thousands of different participants from different backgrounds, with different contexts, with different concerns, over the course of decades, I believe. Decades on that. Now, I want us to think about, If that is true, then what does that do to challenge, what does that say about our faith? Because we already established probably that the first gospel is not written until 3 decades after the time of Jesus. And so if this is true, what does that say about what we claim about Jesus? What does it say? Exactly. It's not possible, he claims, to maintain an oral tradition for 3 decades. You cannot do it. By that time, it's going to be embellished to the point that you cannot rely on what it has to say. That's exactly what he's saying right there. Now, we'll look a little bit more in detail in just a few moments in this, but I want to first off point out that the analogy of the telephone game is not a fair analogy right here. You will hear this used often. People, if they start realizing there's 30 years right there, oh, you know that game you play and you whisper from one person to another, and when it all gets to the end, have you ever played that at some point? It's called Chinese Whisper sometimes, and you did that. And so, I mean, I always hated that game when I was little, and so when I was little, I would always change it and be like, be in class and the teacher's hair looks like a mangy Wookiee's armpit or something like that by the time it gets around to the end. And so it's basically a game that you try to figure out how long you can maintain the message. The difficulty is that in the first century, they reliably were able to memorize things and pass them from generation to generation in ways that is difficult for us in a written culture to imagine. You can find it still today in other, what we might call primitive cultures, cultures that rely on oral traditions. You can find that in Native American cultures at times. You can find that in African cultures at times, where they are able verbally to pass on and memorize things from one generation to another. But it's hard for us to imagine because we live in a written culture. But we'll get back into more in that in a little bit. The New Testament, he claims, This is, again, the skeptic's claim. This is Bart Ehrman. Were written 35 to 65 years after Jesus' death, not by people who were eyewitnesses. Look at that. He says they weren't eyewitnesses. Remember that, just as a sidelight. But by people living later. After the days of Jesus, people started telling stories about Jesus, about him, in order to convert others to the faith. Stories were changed with what would strike us today as reckless abandon. They were modified, amplified, and embellished, and sometimes they were made up. That's the claim. Again, popular book that he wrote, in which he makes this claim. If this is true, the stories we believe about Jesus have no more claim to historical truth than the stories of Mithras or other ancient gods. And you will, in fact, find people claiming that. You will find people claiming that all the stories of Jesus, they can be found in the stories of other gods and goddesses. Has anybody ever heard that claim at any time? Or like that? You've got a few of you who've heard that. That all the stories of Jesus, they can all be found in other gods and goddesses, the claims of them. Now, first off, be really careful about that claim, because if you follow that through most of the time, they are making connections between Jesus and other gods and goddesses that simply are not good history. For example, Mithras. Let's pull that one as an example. You often read, for example, that Mithras was born in a cave with a field and around a field, and was born of a virgin. I've read that many times, people making that claim, that the god Mithras, so the ancient god Mithras, that he was born in a cave beside a field with shepherds, and that he was born of a virgin. If you actually go look at the Mithraic text and actually translate, look at that Mithraic text that they are looking at. First off, it simply says that some different persons who were in the field came to assist in the birth. It doesn't say they were shepherds. We don't know what they were. We don't know if they were shepherds that are being claimed or not. And so it just simply says they came that. But here's the most incredible thing about it. What actually happens with Mithras is born directly out of the rock. Like, the cave is because he's born out of the rock. Now, I guess that's sort of a virgin birth, okay? I'm not sure how rocks, you can tell if they're a virgin or not or anything like that, but but yet they make a claim based on that's just like Jesus. It is not just like Jesus. It's radically different from that, so always be careful about that claim. But the claim that's being made here is basically that there's no more claim for Jesus than for all of these other gods and goddesses whose stories circulated in the ancient world. Yet here's what we find if we look at the evidence. Strong evidence exists to suggest that a stable oral history of the crucial events of Jesus' life emerged less than 3 years after his death, and that the essential content of this oral history remained unchanged as it spread across the Roman Empire. Let me show you why we can tell that that's true. Let's take a look at, just as an example, just the oral culture first. Let's look at the oral culture, how this actually functioned, how it worked in the first century. What they would do is, in the oral culture of the first century, acts and teachings were summarized in oral histories that reliably circulated over long periods of time. What they would do is they would come up with a way that might rhyme or might have a certain rhythm or something like that, so that you could memorize something and you could pass it generation to generation and keep that going over a long period of time relatively unchanged. Philo of Alexandria, he puts it this way. He says, instruction moves in a leisurely way. He lingers over it and spins it out with repetitions, thus permanently imprinting the thoughts in the hearer's souls. Now, this is not a Christian. This is a Jew, an Alexandrian Jew. And he's speaking, though, of how the instruction occurs in terms of developing what we would call today an oral tradition. So that's simply how it was done in the ancient world. And here's what we find as we look at the New Testament. Let's take this document right here. This is from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 7. Paul writes, "For I passed on to you what I also received, that the Messiah died on behalf of our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he rose again on the third day, and he appeared," and let's see, test my memory right there, "according to the Scriptures, he was seen by Cephas, then by the 12, he was seen by more than 500 brothers at once, and he was seen by James, and then by all the apostles." Now, we're going to look at some key things in here. This is an oral tradition that is recorded in our New Testament that we can date back all the way to the 30s, within a few years of the time of the death of Jesus. I want to look at some key terms in this. Number one is there's these terms passed on and received. In Greek, that's paralambano and paradidomi are the words for that right there. Those are technical terms used in the ancient world to let people know this is an oral tradition that he is getting ready to share with them. He's getting ready to share with them an oral tradition that is being passed on reliably. When these markers occur in a text, it is letting the person know you don't change what I'm about to say. This is something we're passing on that we want to make sure is reliably maintained, and you don't change it. So that's a marker to let us know that. Now, this is written down 20, maybe 30 years after the time of Jesus, between 20 and 30 years after the time of Jesus. So, but right now, what we're being indicated just by that is he's letting them know this is an oral tradition, and I don't want it to be changed. Now, Paul's previous visit had occurred to Jerusalem. Well, let's actually look at this part here first. The and that, kai hati in Greek, and that. And here's what's important about the kai hati, or the and that. What that indicates is what is known as a Semitic vav consecutive. I'm not going to go into all the details of what that means. I will just summarize it in this. It means that this oral tradition is translated into Greek from a Semitic source, language. Now, do you know where they speak Semitic languages? Aramaic, Hebrew, those related to that? Around Jerusalem. When was Paul last in Jerusalem? Paul's previous visit had occurred 5 years earlier. And at that time, from his writings in Galatians 1:17, it seems that he would have received this oral tradition in Jerusalem when he was there several years earlier, probably around 35 AD. Do you see what I'm saying in that right there? So Paul has received this oral tradition, probably in a Semitic language. He translates it into Greek. And here's what's interesting on this. He has been to to visit the Corinthians in the past, and he says to them, I passed on to you when I was there before. So in other words, between the first time he visited and the second time he visited, he hasn't changed it since then. And not only that, because if it's from a Semitic source, it almost certainly means that he got it while he was around Jerusalem. So he got it in the 30s probably, the mid-30s AD. So within a few years of the death, burial, and the reported resurrection of Jesus Christ, Paul got this information. This information can be traced all the way back to within a few years of the time of Jesus. It can be traced back to that. In other words, this thing of, oh, it's like telephone, and went 30 years and got changed, that's fluff. The fact is that there are oral traditions that occur that have the essential stuff of the life of Jesus that go all the way back to within a very few years of the very life of Jesus. And we can demonstrate that from the text that exists. And that. Let's look at the next section right here. This is another indication that it is probably comes from an Aramaic or Hebraic source, Simon Peter's Aramaic. Why did he use Simon Peter's Aramaic name? It's because he's working from a source that comes from an area they speak the Semitic languages, is the reason he would do that. All right, let's kind of go a little bit deeper into this. The passages such as this oral history suggest that accounts of the life of Jesus emerged early in the context of eyewitnesses and remained relatively unchanged as they spread across the Roman Empire. They remained relatively unchanged as they spread across the Roman Empire. Does anyone have any questions on this? I know that's a lot of information just so far. Does anybody have any questions? Is there something you don't get on that or want to make sure you understand? Yeah.
Did he not have access to all this information and go through the text?
Oh yeah, he's aware of that. He's a good scholar. He's a well-trained scholar. He's trained as Bart Ehrman. He teaches at University of North Carolina Chapel Hill. He went to Moody Bible Institute in Princeton, and went all the way through Princeton, and yet he's denied his faith since then. And so what I want to demonstrate is that even working with the text he's working with, you can disprove his case working with his text. Good question though. Yeah. Anyone else? Good question. All right, let's plow a little farther into this. copied accurately, formulated soon after his death, and circulated reliably, was connected to eyewitnesses, and was substantiated in independent accounts that agree. We've looked at the first two. Let's go through as far as we can through the others. What can we know about the Gospels? Let's look at what we can actually know about the Gospels. Here's the claim. The Gospels that came to be included in the New Testament were all written anonymously. When Christians recognized the need for apostolic authorities, they attributed these books to apostles and close companions of apostles, Mark, the secretary of Peter, and Luke, the traveling companion of Paul. Scholars continue to call these books Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as a matter of convenience. They had to be called something, and it doesn't make much sense to call them George, Jim, Fred, and Sam. This is, again, Bart Ehrman speaking on this right here. And once again, if this is true, what does this say about our faith? If what he's claiming is true, what does it say? It's not grounded in eyewitness accounts. If it's not grounded in eyewitness accounts, then there's a problem right there. Because when you're talking something as substantial as a resurrection from the dead, that's a pretty big deal. I've not seen it happen personally, okay? Not many people do. It's really, really rare. I mean, this, do you see the enormity of what we're claiming, that somebody was raised from the dead? We want an eyewitness account. We want an eyewitness account to this. So his claim is that they were written anonymously. And there's some things that he's got on his side right there in terms of the evidence. It is true that the earliest manuscripts don't seem to have included the author's names. But this doesn't mean they were written anonymously. He goes from the fact that they were written originally without the author's names on them and claims from that therefore they were anonymous. That doesn't mean they were anonymous. That's really important. We'll see that in a little bit. The foundation for this claim is the fact that when the titles began to be found on gospel manuscripts, the titles take different forms. And we'll look at that in just a little bit, but just know that one might say kata mataion on it. It'll say according to Matthew. Another one will say the gospel according to Matthew, euangelion kata mataion. Another one might say the divine beginning of the gospel according to Matthew. They may have different forms, so he's claiming from that they start getting added in the early second century, therefore they just made it up. They get made it up, because there's variations in them. Therefore, there must have been a time after the text began to be copied when the titles were added, since there's variations in them. Let's look at this a little bit more. Let's look first off at some places we find some manuscripts right here. Let's look at some. Now, you've got over here in around Rome, okay? You've got Justin Martyr, early to mid-second century, talking about Peter's memoirs over there. It's a reference to the Gospel of Mark. You've got a Muratorian fragment, mid-second century. It talks about the third book of the Gospel according to Luke and the fourth of the one according to John. And that's located over here in Rome. Remember, there's no email. There's no quick transit. There's no ways that you get information out quickly to a huge number of people. So you've got the Gospels Gospels being copied over here, clustered over here. You also have from over here, Papias of Hierapolis, we know from his writings in the early second century, he speaks of the Gospel of Mark and of Matthew. He speaks of all the Gospels there, so they're getting copied over here. We know they're getting copied all the way down to Egypt. This is the earliest fragment of the New Testament called P52. That's not the original, that's a digital image of it. But you got that right there, and it's about that big. It's from about 100 AD, around that time. That's in Egypt, found in Egypt, so it's being copied around in there. So what you see is that you have gospel manuscripts that are scattered all over the world at this time. All over the world, you have gospel manuscripts scattered. Now, let's just imagine something. I do this sometimes for real in classes. But let's just imagine that I took and photocopied a page from a book. Let's say James Joyce's Ulysses, which is considered, even though nobody's probably read it, it's considered one of the great books of the English language in the 20th century. And I had this pages from it, and I put one of them over here with one of you, one back there and one back there, and I had each of you on your own try to figure out, without using your cell phone to go Google it or anything like that, without doing that, if to have you figure out who wrote the page that I photocopied. And inevitably, here's what happens. One person might come up with James Joyce. Usually one person does. The other persons, they are pretty much, they're everywhere from Emily Dickinson to Mark Twain. Okay? Now, in a room with pretty educated people, we can't figure out who wrote something and agree on it just across the room, independently. You know what he's claiming? Because here's what, let's actually look at some evidence right here. Actually take a look at some things. So for that in your mind, if the apostles' names had been added in the early second centuries to gospels that had already spread throughout the Roman Empire, the names of the authors ought to vary from each other. That's what we would expect to find. You know what we actually do find in the manuscripts? Every time that it has a title of the Gospel of John, it will say John, John's Gospel. In other words, there's no version of the Gospel of John that says Matthew on it. There's no version of John's Gospel that says Luke on it. There's no version of John's Gospel that says Peter on it. It always says John on John's Gospel. It may say according to John. It may say Gospel according to John. It may say some variation of that. But it will always have the name John if it has a title at all. If it has a title at all. In other words, think through this. The Gospels are scattered all over the ancient world in the early second century, and they start putting names on them. And somehow everybody starts connecting the same Gospels with the same authors at the same time. How would they do this? Why, when they start putting those titles on, does every time they put a title on the Gospel of Matthew, they put Matthew on that, even though the other parts may vary of the title? Let's actually look at an example of this. These are two actual manuscripts right here. It's Codex Sinaiticus. It says Kata Ioannane right there. Kata Ioannane, which means according to John. Codex Washingtonianus says Evangelion Kata Ioannane on it. Gospel according to John on it. So the forms of the titles differ, but once they start putting these titles on, they always put the right names on the right texts. Here's what happened. And it's fairly clear that it happened. How were the same names so consistently connected to the same New Testament Gospels after the Gospels had circulated throughout the Roman Empire? When they passed on the Gospel, they passed on an oral history with it. When they handed on one gospel to another church and that church copied it and the next church copied it and passed it to another church, when they passed it on, they said, hey, this is the gospel that Mark wrote. Or this is the gospel that John wrote. Or this is the gospel that Matthew wrote or Luke. When they passed it on with a story about how it came about. And in fact, we find these stories written down. And different people in different circumstances will come up with the same story for how they came about. Papias of Hierapolis, late 1st, early 2nd century, he talks about that Mark came from the recollections of the Apostle Peter. Matthew, he says, in the Hebrew dialect, placed sayings in orderly arrangement. And so he's operating from this, and he says that this was an oral tradition that was passed on to him. We have in another place, somebody writing in another place at another time under different circumstances says that Matthew composed his gospel and he talks about the circumstances of that. And he talks about that Mark, Peter's follower and interpreter, so he has the same story as the other one. What we find is that each of these had received the same story when they received the gospels. The gospels were written without titles originally. They were not written anonymously. They were passed on with a story about who wrote that gospel. We find another example of this. I believe this is from the Muratorian fragment in the mid-second century. The third book of the gospel, and he speaks of much of the same things that we've talked about, and he passes that on. We find another example of this, and this one is from Tertullian. He says, the gospel testimony has apostles for its authors. There are some that, though not apostles, are apostolic. They do not stand alone. They appear with and after the apostles. So John and Matthew of the apostles first instill faith into us, while the apostolic writers, Luke and Mark, renew it afterwards. Never mind that there occurs some variation in the arrangement of their narratives, as long as there is agreement in essential matters of faith. All right, let's kind of pull some of this together. Does anyone have any questions over that? That's tough stuff, but I want you to be aware of it. Does anyone have any questions on that? Anyone? Do you understand the concept right there? The idea that the Gospels were written, people knew who wrote them, and they could connect them back to eyewitnesses. That's important to understand. The Gospels, they knew who wrote them, and they could connect them back to eyewitnesses. Do you want to have any questions on that? Anyone? All right, let's wrap this together in the last part right here. The other claim that's often made is that there's just not enough historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. For this. You got this on your sheet, so I'm going to let you be able to look at it there rather than me going through it here. You can look at it later on. Here's the claim again. This is Bart Ehrman's claim at this point. All of our early Gospels, not just John and Mark, with Matthew and Luke as well, but also the Gospel of Peter. I wish we could talk more about that. This is one that's a fake Gospel written by somebody besides Peter. And just take that right there. You can look it up at some point. But that's what it is. Which appears to be independent of all of them, indicate that it was Mary Magdalene who discovered Jesus' empty tomb. It seems hard to believe that this just happened by way of a fluke of storytelling. It seems much more likely that, at least with the traditions involving the empty tomb, he has to admit this. Now, he says that something else had to happen to the body, but he admits that we're dealing with something rooted in history. The resurrection claims are claims not only that Jesus' body came back alive, it came back alive never to die again. That's a violation of what naturally happens every day, time after time, millions of times a year. What are the chances of that happening? It would be so highly improbable that we can't account for it by natural means. By very nature of the canons of historical research, we can't claim historically that a miracle probably happened. Now, here's what's interesting. Now, look at this. For the resurrection of Jesus, look at the evidence right there. Look at the evidence. You have 1 Corinthians 15, 3-7, an oral tradition that emerges in the early 30s, written down around AD 55, that there's crucifixion, raised on the third day, many people saw him alive. You have Mark 16, 1-8, which is found in adapted form in Matthew and Luke, and resurrection on the third day, Mary Magdalene is the first witness. You've got John's Gospel, written in the mid to late first century, crucifixion, resurrection on third day, Mary Magdalene is first witness. We're going to skip that one for right now. Gospel of Peter, which is totally independent of the New Testament Gospels, and yet is based on some tradition that had occurred in the past. It's not written by an apostle, but it's still important because we find it as crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, and Mary Magdalene is the first witness. Now, if you have 4 different witnesses making the same claim in different times and in different places, typically in a court of law, that tells you that something really and truly happened. And yet the claim is, that can't have happened. It just can't have happened. I'm not going to go through into details of this right here, but just be aware that everything is in place in terms of the witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus. Everything. That we ought to consider it to be good history. Not just good theology, but good history. If the most consistent historical evidence fits with a miraculous event, there's every reason to believe that the miraculous event occurred, especially if independent sources attest to the event. There are 4 separate sources that agree that Jesus was raised from the dead on the third day. 3 of those, independent of each other, say Mary Magdalene was the first person that saw it. 3 of them, independent of each other. Why would you have that detail except for one possibility, which is that it really happened? It really happened. You don't get details. If you go in a court, as I said, and you have 3 separate witnesses who have not interacted with each other, or at least have not done so for a long, long time, and they agree not just on the fact, but on crucial details, you come to the conclusion that the event really happened. There's another reason for that, and I'll wrap up with this. You don't realize the degree to which crucifixion, what it was in the ancient world. Did you know that the word crucify was a bad word in the ancient world? So one document, and a prostitute says to a client who's been giving her difficulties, as he walks out, she says, "Go get yourself crucified." That was the nastiest thing they could say, the dirtiest thing you could say. You got other examples of that where you don't find the word crucify, you don't find it in the legal documents. They will call it the ultimate end, the final execution, the ultimate pain, the criminal beam. They will call it all these other things, but they won't say the word crucifixion because it was vulgar. It was vulgar. We don't realize the degree to which crucifixion was a nasty thing in the ancient world. And the claim that your Messiah, your God, was crucified is not something somebody's going to make up as part of a telephone game. Roman philosopher Seneca, he says, I see the stakes there, not one kind but many. Some victims are placed head down. Some have spikes driven through their genitals. Others have their arms stretched out upon the gibbet. He describes just the vulgarity and the nastiness of crucifixion. It's one of the earliest Christian-related bits of art to do with crucifixion. It says in Greek, Alexamenos sebete theon, or theou, at that, but it says, Alexamenos worships his God. It's found at the Palatine Hill in Rome. And it's ridiculing somebody named Alexamenos because he worships a God who was crucified. And it says, in essence, you worship a God who is crucified. Your God is nothing more than a donkey. That's what it's claiming. Yet millions of people accepted Jesus Christ and followed him. And the initial people, in spite of the fact he'd been crucified, followed him. Why would you follow someone who had just been crucified a few days earlier unless you really saw them alive? You see that? With no clue of the vulgarity of crucifixion in the ancient world. We don't have a feel for that. And the fact that that is one of the greatest reasons that we can know that what is claimed in the Gospels is true, because it's a story too strange to be fiction. I remember when The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe came out. And I'm a mean father on this. I make my daughter, before you go to see a movie, if it's based on a book, you must read the book first. That's the rule. You cannot go see a movie based on a book unless you have read the book first. So, before she could go see the movie. The deal was, if you read the book before opening day of the movie, you and your friend can go with you and can go and see that movie. We'll take you both on opening day if you do that. So that was the deal. So we went to see The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And there's the scene, the powerful scene, very well done, in which the witch kills Aslan the lion. And I heard Hannah lean over and she whispered to her friend, who had not read the book. She said, "Don't worry, I read the book. He doesn't stay dead." And that's exactly what I think as I read the Gospels, is, don't worry, I read the book. He doesn't stay dead. And it's attested not just by claims of here's what I think is true, but by history and independent witnesses claiming together that this really happened. So what do you do with the information? As you study and you become more convinced of your faith, don't be a jerk about it. Just because you know the truth doesn't mean you can be a jerk, okay? Don't be. Be kind and gracious in your arguments with others. Be able to be winsome and loving and yet argue for the truth at the same time. Know what you really believe. Dig into what you really believe on things. And don't be satisfied with what you know now. Don't think, oh, I got all this information. Now I know everything I need to know. No. No. Don't be satisfied with what you know. Here's some books. These two are debates right here. If you're interested in these types of subjects about just the controversies about who Jesus is, my book, Misquoting Truth. And by the way, the upside down on the cover, if you wonder why it's that way, that's kind of an inside joke, okay? And I'll tell you why, what happened with that. Bart Ehrman's book, Misquoting Jesus, whoever put together the cover put the Hebrew text on it upside down. And so it was a way of kind of joking about the fact that somebody got the Hebrew text upside down on the front of his cover, but to say basically he's turning the story about Jesus upside down. So if you wonder why, that's why. That's why we did that on that. And they later, on the later edition, they corrected it and turned the right side up on his cover because, anyway, because if you know Hebrew and you look at it, it looked really weird on that. So, that's my book, Misquoting Truth. Conspiracies on the Cross. In this book, I go through all the different major conspiracies about Jesus and go through each one of them and try to deal with them from the evidence of history. If you want to go even deeper than in some of the areas, there's a book by Paul Eddy called The Jesus Legend, which is a really good book on these type of issues. So don't be satisfied with what you know now. Dig deeper into it and come to know the truth even more.